its work. And I think there's a very intimate connection. You know, sometimes if you have a major disruption in your home, maybe, you know, you have your neighbor kids come in and have a field day in your house, and everything gets turned upside down, and it's kind of a mess. But in that mess, you suddenly discover long forgotten things that were kind of unearthed under the couch or in the cracks of the couch or, you know, in various places you didn't know were there. Some of those things might be family heirlooms that were lost in the cracks of the couch. And some of them might be the amazing amount of dust that was under the couch. You thought you were a good housekeeper, but underneath that couch, boy, you had no idea what it looked like there. So in the same way, the United States has had a series of major disruptions over the last month with the two major hurricanes. And one of the things it's done is that's kind of, you know, disrupted the whole nation and stirred things up and revealed things that often are hidden or not noticed, kind of things that are lost in the cracks. And so certainly some of the things are quite beautiful. I think it's quite amazing, the outpouring of generosity exhibited by many, many people, and people going to help in the South and sending money and supplies. I think it's really beautiful. And very profound to have that connection. 2 weeks ago, I think it was, I gave a talk after the Hurricane Katrina, and we donated all the money from all the teacher and the operations Donna to Second Harvest to be able to support their work in New Orleans. And I was quite inspired that just from the Sunday morning crowd, there was raised $4,300. And then I learned that at Spirit Rock, they've been doing the same thing. And at Spirit Rock, because they have a lot of classes and a lot of people there, they raised $54,000, last I heard the numbers. And that money went directly to a group that I didn't even know about because I'm not connected so widely, but a group that's connected to Spirit Rock in Louisiana, a large sitting group, I guess, or a sitting group. And that money went directly to them. And they went and set up tables at the Superdome and had the booth and were kind of receiving people and checking them out. And if they needed, you know, a bus ticket or needed something. And they were handing out $200, $300, $500 at a time, depending on what the need was, to get people kind of going and started or kind of help them, you know, in the immediacy of that situation. So here was a grassroots effort that, you know, directly out of our Buddhist community also was going in there and helping in a way that sometimes we expect maybe the government to be doing things. And so the disruption of these hurricanes has certainly revealed some really beautiful aspects of the country. And it's also revealed some of the dark sides or the difficult sides of our culture. And so we have, and maybe the long-term impact of these hurricanes is not the damage they've done, but rather the way in which public consciousness has been awakened to the degree of poverty that exists in this country. It's been said over again by many commentators now that America has been very good at avoiding, denying the level of poverty that exists, pushing it aside. And it's kind of a wake-up call, the degree to which poverty is here. And the figure that I keep reading is 37 million people in this country living under the poverty line. And under the poverty line is an amazingly low number to begin with. And so if you even go beyond that little bit, you know, you get a lot of people living in poverty. 36 million people, a million less than under the poverty line, are said in the United States to go hungry at some point during the year. We're having food as an issue. About the same size as the state of California. That many people, you know, are living clearly in poverty. And so the hope now has been that America will remember this and take this into account and somehow respond in a way that's appropriate given this public awakening to the level of poverty in this country. People don't have enough money to get on a bus to leave New Orleans. People don't have enough money to go you know, have enough food in the house to be able to get to the next day. People disrupted, had to leave, managed to get out somehow or other, but have no bank accounts, no social security numbers, no nothing, left with their clothes on their back, and were so poor that, you know, they had a place to live maybe in New Orleans and had a way somehow of making ends meet, but they lost it all and now are basically without anything in some other place. So how do we respond to that? What's our relationship to the world? What is this world that we live in? How do we understand the world? And how do we understand our relationship to the world that we live in? Is a very profound and important question for everybody. So what is the connection of this then to Buddhist practice? How does Buddhist practice inform these kinds of questions about our relationship to the world and the suffering of the world? There is a beautiful story from the time of the Buddha of a monk who had dysentery. And the monk lay there where he had fallen down in his own excrements. So he was quite sick. And he was laying there in his own excrements. As the Buddha was walking about, he came to the lodging of that monk. When he saw that monk lying where he had fallen in his own excrements, he went over to him and said, "Brother, what ails you?" "I have dysentery." "But is there anyone taking care of you?" "Brother, no." "Why is it that the monks do not take care of you? Why don't your fellow monks take care of you?" "I am useless to the monks, therefore the monks do not take care of me." And that's a pretty amazing thing in itself. If you ever wondered, you know, about monks. I take it not to be a general statement about monks, but some people are clueless. Some people don't understand what goes on right in front of them. So I'm useless. Then the Buddha said to Venerable Ananda, his primary attendant, "Go, Ananda, and fetch water. We will wash this brother." When Ananda had fetched water, the Buddha poured it out, and Venerable Ananda washed the brother all over. Then the Buddha, taking him by the head, and the Venerable Ananda, taking him by the feet, together they laid him on a bed. Then the Buddha, in this connection and on this occasion, gathered the order of monks together and questioned them, saying, "Monks, is there in such a lodging a brother who is sick?" "There is," they said. "And what ails that brother?" "He has dysentery," they said. "But is there anyone taking care of him?" And they said, "No." You're supposed to be honest when you're a monk. I hope they gulped. "Why not? Why do the monks not take care of him?" "The brother is useless to the order of monks. That is why the monks do not take care of him." So that's, again, a very strange statement, you know, useless. You know, is their spiritual life so selfish and self-absorbed, you know, that they don't see the connection between compassionate service to someone else and their own practice? Or the monks are, in a sense, are supposed to be the, you know, primarily interested in the path of liberation and becoming free. And monastic life is supposed to create the optimal conditions, in theory, of engaging in the spiritual life. And here people kind of dedicated to this life are saying that a sick person is useless? Well, so the Buddha said to them, "Monks, you have no mother and no father to take care of you, now that you're monks. If you will not take care of each other, who else will? Monks," and this is the very important statement that I'm about to read, so for emphasis I'll mention that ahead of time. "Monks, those who would attend to me, let them attend to the sick." Those who attend to me, let them attend to the sick. This is a very powerful statement, especially in Indian religious circles, where attending to the guru — the Buddha wasn't a guru, but attending to the spiritual teacher — is understood to be a very powerful form of spiritual practice, a very powerful form of making merit to support spiritual life. And in the Buddhist tradition, no one is more, you know, venerated, worthy of attending and serving and being part of than the Buddha. And here the Buddha is saying, those who would attend to me, let them attend to the sick. It's as significant. I take the sentence to mean it's as significant to attend to the sick as it is tend to the Buddha. And so if attending to the Buddha is a very central kind of religious practice in much of Buddhism, tending to the teacher in some way, well, how is it that tending to the sick is as worthy, as important? Now to kind of change directions a little bit and come back to this. As I've read the teachings of the Buddha and the stories from the Buddha's life, what seems to me comes across is that compassion, compassionate response, is assumed. That there is no doctrinal discussion about why you should be compassionate or how it's, you know, just the dynamics of it and rationale for it. It's just assumed that people are going to be compassionate. As you go into Mahayana Buddhism, and there starts to becoming a Buddhology, a theology, kind of Buddhology, a dharmology, explaining the rationale or the connection or the kind of natural workings of compassion much more, not just assumed in the same way. But, for example, they'll say that compassion is a natural or innate, is innate in the experience of emptiness. That emptiness is one of the central features of the Mahayana, the doctrine, the experience, an insight into emptiness. But that insight into emptiness is not empty of everything, but somehow, in some way, different people emphasize, talk about it different ways, that emptiness itself contains within it compassion, the compassionate response. When you get to the modern Buddhist, as I say it this way, kind of modern Buddhism in America, it has a teaching which is shared by other spiritual traditions in America, and that is that they'll say that the open heart will naturally be compassionate. That if your heart is open and clear and sensitive to what goes on around you, that open heart will be compassionate. I think all of these traditions are all kind of saying that you can assume that in its kind of natural workings, the human heart, the human sensitive mind, will respond compassionately when we encounter suffering in the world. And so, and many people have found that to be the case. People who do mindfulness, something like mindfulness meditation or meditation practice, that as fear falls away, as ambition falls away, as ill will and hate falls away, as the busyness of the mind falls away, the distractions of the mind fall away, and we start really kind of letting the mind be sensitive to itself, where we really kind of see the heart kind of operating without these distractions, that the heart seems to respond to the world around us in very intimate ways. And some of that ways, when they're suffering, is the response of compassion. Do we need to have a rationale for why we should be compassionate? Do we? The Buddha didn't seem to offer a rationale, except, you know, something like this. You know, if you tend to me, tend to the sick. He just assumed there was there. I think that as the crust on the heart dissolves, then compassion is there. You don't need a rationale for why you should be compassionate. It's just kind of right there. But a rationale for compassion is still something people like to have, even if they feel it's a natural part of who they are. This last 2 days, there have been three kind of, maybe four kind of, you know, currents that come together for me in wanting to give this talk about service. One is certainly the hurricanes in the south. The second is that I was asked on Friday to come and be part of a panel talking about Buddhism and service. And the third and the fourth, the reason is that both Friday and Saturday, I met here in this room with people either being trained on Friday, trained in the skills of Buddhist chaplaincy, being chaplains and working as Buddhist chaplains in hospitals or prisons or hospices. And then yesterday, being together with people who are doing that work of Buddhist chaplaincy all over many places in the state, and some people from outside the state that came here and had a discussion of the state of Buddhist chaplaincy. And as Buddhist chaplaincy becomes a kind of a field in its own right, and we need to talk with other people doing Buddhist chaplaincy, there's often come a desire to understand what's the rationale for Buddhist compassionate response. Just say, oh, just assumed. You know, we just do it. That's what we do. You know, we don't think about it, but you know, when your neighbor hurts, you go and help your neighbor. And you don't think about, you know, why you should do it. When your child is sick, you middle of the night, you get up and take care of your child. You know, you don't kind of look up in the book and find out the reasons why you should, you know. One of the surprises of me of being a parent, so many surprises. But one of the surprises is what it was like to have my son throw up in my cupped hands. You know, in the middle of the night, he was sick, you know, and you know, it was either that or all over the carpet. And I never imagined I'd ever put my hands out like this to receive someone's vomit. And it wasn't as bad as I thought it would be. You know, it was, well, that's... And little bit my hope is that that his experience of his father kind of receiving him that way, rather than, ooh, was important for him and his formation as his development. So, you know, luckily I didn't have to look up in the book first, you know, why I should respond that way. It's just assumed, it's there, it's natural, or it's almost... But is there a rationale for in Buddhism for compassion? In the Theravada tradition, in all of Buddhism, there's a certain ideal called the Bodhisattva, and it's in its most classical idea, the Bodhisattva is someone who is endeavoring to become a Buddha. And as it's developed, especially in the modern West, a Bodhisattva is anyone whose practice is intimately connected to wanting to help others, wanting to help others develop the path, help others in their direction, in their cultivation of liberation and freedom. In the Theravada tradition, there is a Bodhisattva path and teachings. People often don't know that. And in my studies of Buddhism, I think that the little corners of the Theravada where they have teachings about the Bodhisattva path, there's a very beautiful articulation of the intimate connection between liberation and compassion. That liberation and compassion are considered to be integrally important and to be understood together. So liberation means your own liberation. Your own liberation to free the heart, for your mind, from whatever keeps it bound, keeps it constricted, keeps it anxious, keeps it afraid, keeps it somehow split and fractured. Somehow to liberate the heart. Compassion has to do with our care and concern for others, our response to the suffering of the world. And so what you find is that the connection between compassion and liberation are like washing your hands when they're dirty. And if you have two hands, then, you know, you take the soap in both hands and one hand washes the other. You know, you kind of go like this, you know. You know, put some soap in one hand and the water kind of like, you know, hoping to get clean. But somehow you have the hands work together, and both hands are dirty perhaps, but both of them work together to clean each other, and then they all help each other get clean. So in the same way, liberation, the path, the motivation, the movement towards our liberation, and the path and the movement towards compassion work together in that same way to purify ourselves and to purify the world, to help the world. It's that intimate. And the ideal here is that we don't see them as being separate, but being mutually reinforcing and mutually supporting. In a sense, maybe the idea is that we are all patients and we're all healers. We are all sufferers, people who suffer, and we are all people who can help alleviate that suffering. That we're not one or the other. We're not only people who are out there to be, you know, the saviors of the world. We're there to help. But in helping, we don't see ourselves as being someone who is not suffering ourselves. But there's this kind of mutuality where we don't see each other as being so separate from each other. So that when we meet someone else and we meet someone who's suffering, we don't think of exactly as them as other, but we don't think of them as being the same either. And this is this wonderful paradox or tension or that exists within Buddhism, that the whole notion of self and other is a little bit difficult to talk about. And sometimes in Zen they say we're neither the same or different. Or they talk about the merging of difference and unity. We're not the same as other people, but we're not different, like our hands. You know, the famous analogy that, you know, the hands are both separate from each other and they're connected, right, through our arms and our torsos. So you can't really say they're separate, but you can't really say that they're the same either. And because they're somehow both separate and the same, they can wash each other. You know, if they're exactly the same, you know, you wouldn't be able to do that washing. You need to have the other. But if they were the same, you couldn't actually wash each other. But if they were radically other, then they wouldn't be the connection to bring them together. So the idea of self and other is a little bit problematic, and it points to the idea that it's important to see others as others, but not to be lost or caught by that otherness of the other. And it's very important to see people as being unique for who they are as individuals or because of their cultural backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, you know, everything about them, that they're unique, to really learn how to see that. And to learn to see them as being somehow the same, but not get caught in them being the same either. Don't be caught either. And the healing of self and other is not by having a view of self and other, not having an idea of self and other, not having an idea of sameness and difference, but rather be able to drop that part of the mind that gets caught in evaluating self and other. So that when we encounter another, it's not exactly we're encountering them as the same as us, not exactly as different, but we're meeting them in a way that's quite intimate. In the Mahayana tradition, there's all these archetypes, bodhisattvas, who are archetypes, great beings, for different qualities. And Avalokiteshvara is the archetype of compassion. In Chinese, it's Kuan Yin. In Japanese, it's Kannon. You know the camera, Canon? Anybody have Canon camera? That name, Canon, comes from the Japanese version of the Chinese version of the Sanskrit Avalokiteshvara. So, and the kind of the connection is, it's the eyes that see the suffering of the world, right? Your camera has this eye that can see the suffering of the world. So, so you probably didn't know your camera was Buddhist. And part of the image of idea, the archetype, is that Avalokiteshvara has all these hands, 1,000 hands sometimes. And in each hand, there's an eye, and that eye, and also in each hand, there's a different tool, 1,000 different kinds of tools. And the idea is that Avalokiteshvara is available to manifest in many different forms to respond to all the suffering that he or she can see through all those hands. All those hands can see, you know, suffering everywhere in all directions. So some people will make compassion into kind of a metaphysical principle, that compassion is always present in the universe and is always ready to see us and receive us. It's that kind of permeates the universe, the idea of compassion. The hands of Avalokiteshvara is everywhere. So there are some Zen koans, Zen teaching stories about Avalokiteshvara. And I don't remember exactly how they go, but close enough. One of them says something like, what is it like to be Avalokiteshvara? What's it like to be the embodiment, personification of compassion? That's pretty great, right? You could be Mother Teresa, you could be the Dalai Lama, you could be this great embodiment of compassion, and you'd just be radiant and shining, and you'd be this great helper, you know, all the right things to say and do at the right time, and, you know, wherever you go, they're just kind of like, you'll just respond with all your wisdom and compassion, and it'll just be great. It would be great to be, you know, to be that way, wouldn't it? And if only, you know. So what is it like to be Avalokiteshvara? And so one monk asks the other that question. And the monk being asked says, oh, it's like in the middle of the night in bed and having your hand reach behind your head to bunch up the pillow. It's a Zen story, right? I love that story. Because here, this idea of, you know, this compassionate response, you know, we hold it up to this high status, this great thing, noble thing to do. And the monk says, you know, it's not such a big deal. Something about compassion is, the compassion response is like, you feel a little bit uncomfortable at night, you're asleep or half asleep, and you don't even think about it. But you take your hand kind of back to kind of help out your head a little bit, and you bunch it up a little bit. It's kind of almost thoughtless, almost kind of, you know, just, it's so natural, so simple, so uncontrived, so unself-conscious. So in the same way, when compassion responds in its own natural way, there's something uncontrived and unself-conscious about it. It's just what needs to happen. It's the response. This is what, you know, our heart wants to do. And one of the very interesting practices to do is to pay attention to when you want to practice an act of generosity or an act of compassion or care for someone. Be very attentive to the smallest little kind of inkling that you want to do it. And then act on it. Or put aside all the reservations that follow in the wake of it. Or stop and look at all the reservations, all the things that get in the way, all the things that, you know, were fear and greed and all kinds of things. Stop. What would be your natural inclination? One of the ways of discovering your innate capacity for compassion is to do something like a meditation practice where your mind settles and gets quiet enough so there's not a lot of obstructions. And then walk into the world and encounter something and see what bubbles up inside of you when there's no obstructions, no busyness in the mind, no fear to get in the way. And, you know, and I suspect that there's a lot of people who have urges towards doing something, helping in some way, but then they hold back. But what happens if we don't hold back? Why do we hold back? So part of the practice is to look at that. So another Zen story. A Zen monk asks, what is it like for Avalokiteshvara to have all those eyes and hands? All those eyes and hands. No, it's just not how it goes. I think it doesn't matter that much how it goes. it's another story. What is it like to be Avalokiteshvara? And the monk answers, it's like having eyes all over my body. All over, you know. That's pretty good, you know, you can see everything, like you're so sensitive. to the world. But the monk who asked the question says, no, that's not a good enough answer. I think he might have given him a grade, like, that's only 80%. They like to give percentages in Zen sometimes, your answer. I remember in Japan, when I was there, they'd ask me questions, and they'd say, oh, that was 70%. Once they asked me these strange questions, and very strange question, and the monk just pointed to the door and told me to leave. Actually, he pointed to the door, very clear he wanted me to leave, and he said to me, come back 20 years before. Well. So the monk says, it's like having eyes, compassion is like having eyes all over my body. And the monk says, that's only 80%. And the second monk says, well, how would you answer? And he says, it's like having eyes throughout my body. So it's a little more intimate. It's like not just on your surface, but just throughout. Like having a sensitive, certain kind of sensitivity that's everywhere. So, so in the Theravada, there's this idea that compassion is innate, or it could be assumed that it's there. And there's the teaching that compassion and liberation should be seen as working together, that they're that intimate. That as we respond to the world, so they work together, not only do they work together, but they may be the same thing at times. And that's the challenge, I think, of people who are engaged in Buddhist social action work. People who are engaged in making their social action, their chaplaincy work, or their engaged Buddhism, or whatever, if they're making it a Buddhist path, the challenge is to understand how that very activity not only supports liberation, but actually is a path to liberation. How maybe the intimacy between liberation and compassion is one, liberation and compassion can occur in the same activity. So, our compassionate response to the suffering of the world is a form of generosity. So we act with generosity, perhaps. Sometimes we offer our actions, our activity, generously, sometimes our resources, sometimes many things we offer. But the practice of generosity requires us to let go of, if we have it, let go of our stinginess, our marginalness, our fear, the things that hold back from being generous. As we act generously and are able to let go of our stinginess or our fear or our hate, that is liberating us from stinginess, fear, and hate. So the very act of the idea is to help someone else, but you're also helping yourself when you take this as a Buddhist practice. You find out how can I act generously here, so that I'm also liberating myself at the same time. You don't have to forget about your welfare in a compassionate response. You don't have to be selfless and not think about yourself. But how is it that you can understand generosity as a way of letting go of self-centeredness, the clinging to self that might stand in the way? So the act of generosity can at the same time both be an expression of compassion and a movement towards liberation. And they work together, if we kind of see it that way. Is that intimate, the two? And then the movement towards liberation. Say you're sitting quietly with your eyes closed in meditation, and you're being present for yourself. As you stay present for yourself, it's kind of like doing house cleaning after the disruption. And you really see ourselves, what's going on. We see many aspects of ourselves. But sooner or later, you'll also see your suffering. And learning to have the capacity present for your suffering, to enter into it, to not turn away, not run away, but to enter the world of our suffering, gives us a kind of inner strength and capacity then to be present for suffering in the world outside of us. As we go inside of ourselves in meditation and learn to empty ourselves, learn not to be limited or constrained by our fear, our hate, our greed, then we, in a sense, become empty, a little bit emptier, so that we can take in others and their situation and then be able to respond in a better way. The three roots of suffering, as taught in the Theravada Buddhism, the three kind of core roots that all our different suffering is supposed to arise out of, is said to be greed, hate, and delusion. And liberation from greed, hate, and delusion at the very kind of foundation of our psyche is what liberation means. But you turn greed, hate, and delusion around. Greed is turned around to generosity. Hate is turned around to love. And delusion is turned around to wisdom. At least it's obvious with the first two that generosity and love have to do with our relationship to the world and to others. And wisdom can be seen a little bit more widely, but also has to do with our connection to the world we live in. So the very movement of liberation, of liberating ourselves, is also a movement of giving freedom or independence, or giving birth to, or releasing from us, so we can operate in the world, releasing from us our capacity for generosity, our capacity for love, and our capacity for wisdom. So not to see the compassionate response to suffering as something that takes us away from our practice, but it's possible to see it as the practice, or as intimately a practice, so that we don't live in a bifurcated world of my spiritual practice, I take care of it and kind of tuck it away and kind of, you know, protect it and kind of avoid the world, but actually see that we can live right in the middle of the world and have the world itself provide us with the path to both liberation and compassion. By the world itself provides us the path of the spiritual life. When we collected many of your donation a few weeks ago for the people impacted by Katrina, the money went to Second Harvest, which is a wonderful organization that's around the country that helps bring food and aid to people. And Second Harvest has been operating in our community, in Palo Alto, East Palo Alto, here in the San Mateo, Santa Clara, for many, many years. Second Harvest didn't just suddenly appear because of Katrina. But even right here in our community, they've been operating and helping people who have been desperately poor without enough money. So I hope that as we develop our mindfulness, develop our meditation practice and our spiritual practice, that we also develop the eyes, that we begin seeing what's going on in our own community, let alone what appears in the newspapers and on television, and be able to be sensitive to really see what's happening here and where the needs are, and that we learn the appropriate way to respond to the needs that are close at home as well as those that are far away. So, thank you very much. Sorry to give a long talk about something that's obvious.